Welcome back to the Redacted Culture Cast. Today we have invited Caleb on to talk about some of the things that we deal with on the ground level. This is less 30,000 foot and more in the weeds and the kind of conversations that we've wanted to host here at Redacted. So, Caleb, would you introduce yourself?
Yeah, my name is Caleb. I run a page called Prevail Armament and my personal page, Caleb Prevail Armament. And I do all sorts of stuff on there. I kind of track my journey through preparedness, and I like to say that we are concerned about calling people to fulfill the roles and responsibilities bestowed on them by God. And that is what we're here for. Naturally, that I believe includes something to do with firearms, but we do a lot of things from preparedness to medical training to homesteading. And my wife's big on that too. And that's kind of how you and I got connected.
It very much so is. I mean, the world can be really small really quickly, but you and I have had a number of conversations, and you've been working on this series where you go through even the founding fathers and you ask some of the questions about whether or not they were Christians or deists. And you try to look at that a bit more analytically through either their writing or some of the other even less public confessions of faith, so to speak. Yeah. And so as much as the American mind is obsessed with whether or not they are Christians, I find it interesting that that obsession very often comes with a hair of dishonesty. And so thank you for the stuff that you've been putting on, man. Like it's not a gotcha. And I think that that's very refreshing as an individual. So if you want to catch some Instagram content that isn't just half naked women trying to do things that are stupid to make you be annoyed, go check out Caleb's page. We'll have a link in the description below.
But yeah, you won't find any of that on my page.
Thank goodness, man. It is an exhausting phrase. I think I wonder if there is somewhere in the world that there is somebody who pays attention to how much I get frustrated with that and then just turns up the volume knob. There has to be somebody at Twitter who's got like the thought thing, the knob. And you're just like, okay, we're going to turn up this and then we're going to turn it back down and we're going to turn it back up. It's just because it has gotten so bad that I don't even use Instagram anymore. I only use it for communications and posting stuff, and then I barely ever like look at the pages. I look at the stuff in my feed, but not anybody else's feed. Not like the Discover You or For You page, because it's like it's not even worth my time anymore. It's literally just trash.
Well, so, not to mention, almost all of us have been shadow banned off of the For You page, anyways. So you wouldn't find anybody who's worth following.
Yeah, and that's actually one of the beautiful things about gun culture. And so I'm actually going to use this as the perfect segue to talk about this episode's sponsor. Now, I'm very excited to announce the first official sponsor of the Redacted Culture Cast. Obsidian Arms is one of those companies that reflects the many facets of gun culture. Not only are their firearms frequently found on competition fields like USPSA and 3-Gun, but they are a Minnesota-based, US-sourced original equipment manufacturer. Obsidian Arms makes their own punch and tool kits for the amateur and professional gunsmith out of Little Canada, Minnesota, that come with a lifetime warranty. Whether it is fine parts that require a Swiss machine, or you're in the design phase and are looking for an American machine shop that is in tune with the needs of gun culture, go check out Obsidian Arms at obsidianarms.com. Thank you, and now back to the show. So we're back, and we were talking a little bit about social media, and we're talking about a whole bunch of bits and pieces. I think it's interesting. One thing about gun culture that isn't a testimony to how you and I got connected is that I think it's actually very organic. It's not an inorganic object. It's not something that is entirely run by, say, algorithms or whoever gets the best buzzwords or whoever has the most, you know, the most Washington Post level ethics. It's very much so. There are certain pages and people and content that get more views naturally because they might reach a larger audience. On our side, I've noticed that if I did a gun review and it immediately did really, really well. It's not been my modus operandi for the Redacted Culture Cast, but it was certainly something that was a fitting a need. Okay, fine. I wasn't planning on that, but now we might have to change some courses a little bit. But you and I got connected not because I found you through some algorithm, but I found you through somebody else. And then we started talking through some, or you found me through somebody else, or one or the other. And it's been some time now, and that's how old our history is. So I as much as we get frustrated with the algorithm, so to speak, the infamous A, it is it's refreshing to see that there are actual real people out there who get connected because they actually just talk to each other.
Yeah. Yeah, I've enjoyed that a lot. If you just look down through like the follower list on pages like mine or like yours, a lot of them are real pages. Like they're not fake bots that, you know, like all this just garbage that goes on social media. Like most of mine are people that I actually interact with fairly regularly. It's mm-hmm. nice having a smaller following to begin with because you get some more of that, but it's also how my page has grown because I interact with people organically and then they share my posts or my stories and then other people follow through those. It's not from some sort of paid ad campaign or something. Mm-hmm. It's people that are actually connected to people that I know. So just like before the show started, you and I were talking about other people geographically and it's like, oh yeah, I know that guy who knows this guy. And it's just cool because we're actually, I think that helps with the community building aspect that everybody talks about. That's real. It's not just this fake internet thing.
So let's start with like the hard question is, do you think, how would you describe the community aspect of gun culture? And I put that in air quotes.
So I'm probably a really bad person to ask because I enjoy my little bubble of gun culture that I've kind of composed. So I hear people talking about like, oh, these guys are arguing about this and these guys are arguing about this. And I get in on that here and there with like the kind of philosophical things. But generally I'm like, what are you guys seeing? I'm just kind of like looking at all these guys saying Christ is King and sharing workout videos and, you know, like, you know, range videos and stuff. Like I like my little subculture of Instagram and I enjoy that I have something that maybe doesn't reflect the greater gun culture that I hear everybody talking about. And maybe that's why I'm kind of like, painfully optimistic about it. Some people are like, yeah, I don't know if you're on the right track with gun culture. And I'm like, I don't know. It's my experience. So
You're not on the right track in regards to you're gonna have a million and a half followers overnight, or you're not in the right track because you're missing the, you know, you're missing the spirit, the boat, the point of it.
Right. Yeah. Because I'm not like all angry about gun culture being so toxic that I'm like not experiencing it, I guess.
Gun culture is toxic because it can never be satisfied with itself.
Okay.
It can never be satisfied. There's never enough innovation. There's never enough. Ammunition's always too expensive. There's always and if everything is good on the inside of the house, there's got to be somebody over there who's trying to ruin it. It's.
I can understand that.
That's probably my shortest way of saying it. Gun culture is never happy because it's just never satisfied.
Yeah. I mean, the other thing is I haven't been in it very long. I jumped into this, you know, since 2020, roughly. Mm-hmm. I mean, I had an Instagram before that, so I was following Lucas and a couple other guys back in like 2014, but that was before I could even own a handgun. So it was really just being entertained by their training. And then I really got into it post 2020. So maybe I just haven't been around long enough to really understand.
No, I don't know if it's about time at this point. It's more you brought a perspective and or a let's call it a worldview in that sense. It's not quite a worldview, but a perspective on it that was you're satisfied with the community that you have at your fingertips. And maybe I am projecting by saying I've I very oftentimes hear the opposite, where it's a sense of loneliness or a sense of not being a part of something.
Yeah.
I wonder how much of that is self-imposed. I know I have done that to myself.
Yeah, I just had a conversation with one of my guys about that today, actually, I think, or yesterday. He sent me a reel that was kind of trending towards those thoughts. And I was like, yeah, man, I used to be in that spot for sure. Like, and I have to be careful not to fall back into it. But I had to realize that like my self-despair and like the rut I was in pre-2020 or into 2020 was kind of because my worldview was centered on me. It was like a self-centered, human-centric kind of a view. So that really easily gets dark. And I talked a little bit with him about, you know, how I believe the solution to that kind of works its way out. But I definitely know where you're coming from with that.
Can you talk about what that took place? What that was like? Have you reached a point where you're able to speak more on describing a very human-centric worldview? Because I don't want it to get lost in jargon.
Yeah, no. I can, yeah. So I would say, pre, like I said, around 2020, a little bit earlier, I was kind of just stuck in a rut. I was working a job that was kind of a toxic environment, which again, I don't know how much of that was self-inflicted, but I would come home, kind of be in a rut, either play video games or watch Netflix or hang out in my small apartment and just do life day in and day out the same way, all the while watching what's going on in politics and society on our little, you know, screen boxes that we carry around. And I was like, just in a pretty dark place because it felt like everything was going the opposite of the way that I wanted to see it go. And there was nothing I could do about it. And then in the midst of all that, I was living a life that I wasn't really satisfied with. And there came a time where it was kind of a process, and I came to some of these behaviors before I came to the understanding of what was actually happening with my worldview. But I got to the point where I was like, you know what, I just have to do something. Like, no matter how small it is, no matter how limited I think the effect is, I've got to do something to make a difference. And
so I got to stop you there. I got it, because I think you might be answering my question, but I gotta fit it in here. You said two things at the same time. You had two things going on. You had a certain, let's call it, lifestyle that you're living, right? Mm-hmm. And you described it as somewhat passive, right? Work, work, toxic environment, come home, rest and recover by Netflix and video games, and then go back to it, and then just kind of rinse and repeat and rinse and repeat.
Right.
And then on the other hand, you had this sense of, it's not foreboding, but this sense of, it kind of had like a doom and gloom, like
absolutely.
What is it? It's like this boomer thing, and I've seen it before, and I've seen it all my life. It's like the country's going to hell, and we can't do anything about it. It's just falling apart, and like we need to do X, whether it's vote for Donald Trump or become Christian again, or. Yep. And so which one was informing the other? Was it your lifestyle that was producing the worldview, or were you watching news and filling your faith box with current events, and then that was informing the depression, which was manifesting in video games and Netflix? Which one do you think was the cause?
Jeez, I would say it's pretty cyclical. I would have to go pretty far back to really figure out which came first, because I mean, I played video games all through my teen years. Most of us from my generation have probably wasted way too much time on it, but I definitely wasn't in as dark of a place as I was then. But I definitely think it's cyclical, because when I first started paying attention to what was going on, kind of in the world and in government back and, you know, high school. So for me, that was 2009 to 2013. And, I was realizing a lot of things about the entertainment industry and about a lot of the behind the scenes stuff. Back then we were just called conspiracy theorists for it, but now it's pretty mainstream information. And I fell into some pretty dark dark places with those realizations. And then I think, yeah, then I think I, that probably informed my slide into passive life, because I was like, yeah, I can't do anything about it. I tried speaking out about it and I was just called tactless, and, you know, that I was too black and white and that I didn't care for other people's views. So I just stopped talking about it altogether and kind of receded into myself. And again, when you're working and trying to make a living and trying to make it by, it's really easy just to really kind of isolate. And that's kind of what I ended up doing.
Yeah, I wonder how much, when I say I wonder, it's something that I've been sort of, I wanted to, looking forward to this conversation with you about, was how much of one informs the other. Because there's certainly a cyclical nature, right? You have the, if you consume too, if you spend too much of your worldview's information on, or if your meta narrative, if your grand story of the world is informed by the news, it will inherently, it will inherently become negative, because bad news sells better than good news. It's statistically that way. And because of that statistic, you're going to be consuming more data points of negativity, and the data points of negativity without any sort of framework to organize them become the dominant worldview. And so this is where news replaced religion, or no, I'm sorry, yeah. News became its own religion. Right. And so yeah. I could see how, if you, let's just say, and this is even like a criticism of like 2013 Alex Jones issues, is if Alex Jones was your worldview, then chances are you would have no hope for the future and then pursue no ambition for achievement.
Right. Yeah.
So Alex Jones might be right, but Alex Jones is not good for the soul in the sense of that is your soul worldview building source.
Yeah. Yeah, I think that makes sense to me. Mm-hmm. And that was definitely my experience too. Not so much with Alex Jones specifically, but it was tough going through a time where I felt like I had control over nothing. I felt like I had no influence or power to enact change. And for a person who's really wired to fix things, like that's my personality, that's I'm analytical and I'm a problem solver. So when I couldn't do that for the things that I really cared about, the next option was just kind of to live for temporary pleasures, temporary things. But it was kind of inside of this Christian worldview, because I've been a Christian for the vast majority of my life. I had a conversion experience when I was very young. So this was framed inside of the Christian worldview. And because of that, I didn't really recede so far into, like, you know, drugs and alcohol and just, you know, really kind of like crazy living. It was just like, I can't do that stuff. So I'm just going to end up sitting home and doing all these meaningless things to kind of just numb the pain or distract myself. And it wasn't until I came to a realization that was like, I have to start doing something. And I actually credit some of the people like Jordan Peterson and the guys in his circle around the time of, like, a little bit pre-2020 and going into 2020 for really encouraging that mentality in me. Was like, okay, I got to accept some sort of responsibility. I just got to do something. Like, even if it's not going to make this huge difference, I can start with myself, start gaining skills myself. And then the people that I care about around me, just encouraging them to start doing the same things. And that's kind of how you can see how that thread would kind of lead into what I'm doing now, because it's basically the same thing, just a little bit of a grander scale. So, it definitely had some theological changes that happened through that time too. I went from like a dispensationalist to more like Reformed theology, and that helped a lot with, like you're saying, negative viewpoints versus some positive points. So a lot changed, but I don't know how much we want to get into each of those different things.
I would like to hear you talk about dispensationalism and why you left it, because when I studied dispensationalism versus What was the other one?
Covenant.
Covenant theology. I didn't see any meaningful difference between the two.
Okay. So maybe I should narrow it down even a little bit more and say pre-tribulation dispensationalism.
Okay.
Because the eschatology and the end times theology has a little bit to do with why the behaviors kind of turn out the way that they do. And basically what happened is you can see this in the camps in America are kind of built, separated into these two different groups where you have like a very pessimistic Christianity that's just like, everything's going to hell in a handbasket. We can't do anything about it. It's all going to get worse until Jesus comes back. There is no saving this world. There's no saving these institutions. So for the last 75 years, we've just seen Christians withdrawing from institutions, withdrawing from politics, and saying, you know, oh, well, we'll just evangelize and try to save as many people as we can on the way out the door. We'll wait for Jesus to come back. And then...
And the criticism being how much evangelism is going on, because I see the dark side of that being attached to, or the dark side of that worldview is it turns the relationship, the actions of the Christian and that whatever it is that that considers a person a Christian to be entirely internal or like a series of even in a philosophical sense or even in regards to trying to write it out in truth statements, that all that faith comes down to is a series of propositions held in one's mind as being true. Like there's no action, there's no participation, it's not faith without works. It's just that the works are obscured through something, and it's a lot of focus on, well, I can't, it's almost like a stoic version of Christianity in its best light, where you can't control the world, but you can control how you react to the world. And right. I wonder if it seems like it falls very reasonably on the shoreline, or it crashes onto the stony shore of stoicism, which is ultimately nihilism and solipsism.
Yeah. Yeah, it definitely turns into a lot of nihilism. And you'll have people who kind of have this, I don't want to call it a facade, because many of them are actually very convinced and they're very happy for their spiritual condition, for their spiritual life, but just extremely pessimistic about anything that's going on in the world. So even getting most of the Christians that I grew up around to talk about politics was like pulling teeth, because they didn't want to have any discussion about this stuff because it was all just kind of like the other people, like the other institutions, the other things. Like, we don't really do that. We have like our Christian camps and our Christian companies and our Christian book dealers, and like we kind of operate in this space and we let the secular world do what the secular world's going to do. And when you look at the covenantal theology side, or even more specifically speaking, because generally these two things are kind of intertwined, but I guess you could have some overlap between the two groups. When you have covenantal theology, a lot of times it ends up being amillennial or postmillennial, meaning that we're either ushering in Christ's kingdom or we're in Christ's kingdom right now, and it's a spiritual reign of Christ. So things are actually getting better since Christ's life, and there's more people converting, there's more Christians, and eventually we will have a state of the earth that is worthy of Christ's coming. And I haven't worked out all my eschatology with that. Like, I'm very new to the end times thing, but it definitely made more sense to me in action than any of the pre-tribulation stuff that I saw growing up.
Yeah. So you could, this in a hyper simplification, you could dress up pre-millennialism as, You could almost condense it into this worldview perception that there is a timeline. It fixed or unfixed is less important, but there is a timeline where it is bad. It is going to continue to get bad. There is going to be an apocalypse, and then it is going to be good. And then amillennialism is the one that is got the funniest name, but is perhaps the least concrete, right? Amillennialism. amillennialism has to do with the, it's kind of a both and argument, right? Mm. Whereas pre, or was it postmillennialism? That's right, Trent.
Right. Yeah.
Yeah.
So like, there's a couple really popular postmillennialists out right now that are making bigger waves, and you'll see like a lot of Presbyterians, Reformed Presbyterians, kind of go this way, and then you'll see like Reformed Baptists are generally like the amillennialists.
Okay.
From my understanding, I'm no professional.
We're not actually making. That's fine. The reason why I'm bringing this up and I wanted to I'm talking with you about it is because it's a subject that I've studied, and even with study, I keep running into the same problem, and that's kind of what's the point. And sometimes there seems to be people who argue for amillennialism, one or the other, amillennialism, premillennialism, and postmillennialism. Blah. Yeah, I'm gonna get all my facial exercises in tonight. But you have all these arguments that are made almost like if I can prove this to be true, then I'm justified in acting that way. Whereas,
okay,
I think that's where I run into the biggest frustration with it all is there seems to be a large body of information that we don't know for certain, but we keep trying to draw from that to justify something that we do have a better source to draw from for these actions, like participate in your communities, get involved in your families, spend time with your community or your people, build your cities, build your communities, build your states and your nations and your countries. None of that requires any of this eschatology, but eschatology is esoteric in that it is valuable to study for its own sake.
Yeah. So I experienced this a lot when I first started mulling over the differences between postmillennialism, amillennialism, and premillennialism. And I had a couple people ask me, because I would argue like against each one, and people are like, well, what the heck do you think? Because you're just playing the devil's advocate with everything. And I'm like, I don't know what I think yet. I'm just trying to figure it out. But what I do know is that people who say that premillennialism is the pessimistic view that everything's just getting worse until Christ comes back, even if the world is getting worse, you're still supposed to follow God's commands.
Yes.
So yep. Even if it's all going to hell in a handbasket, you're still supposed to evangelize. You're still supposed to, like you said, build community, to defend the weak, to protect, to provide, all these different things. So the premillennialist who chooses to be pessimistic, this is me, you know, 5 years ago, who chooses to be pessimistic and just fall into this pit of despair is, one, not acknowledging God for who he is, and then two, not following God's commands. So regardless of where you fall on this spectrum, you got work to do. And I think the church should acknowledge that. Now, there is some value to what is the church's role specifically, depending on that theology. So like Doug Wilson would say, our goal is to build institutions. And this is, interestingly, with the Founding Fathers discussion, this is related because they had a pretty well, I don't know the word, congregated, like all of their views kind of pointed towards, not all of them, but most of them, towards one theology and one eschatology. And that's why they were so sincere and serious about building institutions based on these founding principles and truths. So I do see a little bit of a distinction between the premillennialist, because the premillennialist, if everything's going to hell in a handbasket, there's no use investing in institutions that are majority owned by the secular world. Whereas the postmillennialist or the amillennialist will say, no, it's our job to either start our own institutions and to have them be so good that they become the primary institutions, or to become involved in those institutions and to bring God glory by bringing him to the forefront in those institutions. So there is some value in the distinction there, I think.
It might be at risk of becoming circular, but why does it have to be you're going to create your own institutions with the belief that it will become the dominant institution? And there's a two-part criticism there, but one of them is if you're going to do it well. And the other one is, I think one thing that robs people like myself, or even like in the conservative world, or even in gun culture as well, is if I can't be Napoleon, I might as well not try.
Yes.
Right. Yeah. And the thought on that one is, well, let's use a very real contemporary example. Harvard, the institution that is called Harvard, is in absolute shame right now. Like, if you have a degree from Harvard, you might as well light it on fire. It is less value. It should have less value than a community college, that has a no-name community college, even though the hierarchy is sort of its own challenge. And the issue being, it's very clear. The president of Harvard is a plagiarist that had to step down, not because of her plagiarism, but because she was anti-Semitic to the wrong people, or whatever it was, whatever the excuse was. But the answer was, it wasn't because she was a plagiarist. Now you have all these world events going on, and Harvard's trying to figure out how to make blind people see an eclipse. You have, like, it gave somebody like David Hogg a giant platform, or believed in his platform, and he was endorsed and supported through that, and he left probably less educated than when he started. And so you have this institution that is Harvard that the only vestigial value that it seems to have is the good old boys club, which is a very powerful thing. You can't just criticize the good old boys club and walk off unscathed.
Yeah.
Right. And there's just, I shouldn't enforce support through that phrase. But so Harvard, right? So we look at Harvard. It's a disgrace. It's an absolute disgrace. Its education and contribution to mankind is a net negative now. I don't know when it started, and I don't really rightly care. And so should there be Christian Harvard 2.0 that leaves Harvard, goes and starts its own institution, and replaces it as the dominant one? This has happened multiple times in the past. You had Yale and Harvard and Princeton, and there's this kind of, you know, trail. The old Princeton fathers were B.B. Warfield, and you had these characters. But we've seen it in microcosms with small schools or even Christian universities turning what you would call maybe into what we might call woke in the contemporary, but go towards like liberation theology or contemporary issues, and then they lose all their theologians because their theologians leave and they go start their own school. But it doesn't. The issue that I think that are the criticism, and this is an arrow pointed both ways, is that you do not have to create the next Harvard to create the new school. You can't just throw out academia because you have bad academics.
Okay. Yeah, I think I'm on board with that.
No. It's a criticism that you can't, like, how many people would sit here and say, well, if I don't have the biggest voice, I have no voice.
Yeah, exactly. That's what I was going to kind of jump on initially, was we saw that with a lot of Christians in general. Is growing up, I learned all about, I went to a private school, and with a Christian curriculum, and I learned all about these giant evangelists, you know, George Whitfield and Spurgeon and all these guys who, ironically, modern Baptists don't really represent Spurgeon like they think they do, but that's just relevant to our earlier conversation. But the feeling of like, well, I'm never going to be this evangelist. I'm never going to be this guy who's preaching on a stage and converting all these waves of people. And the average Christian's just kind of therefore encouraged to be content with like, I'll do life as a Christian. And if anybody asks me about it, then maybe I'll give them a little bit of my input. And it's like, why does it have to be that either end of the spectrum? Like, we're all capable of this investment and have these skills and gifts that are given to us by God that we can utilize to the best of our ability individually. And that was the second thing I was going to mention when you asked about institutions and having to do things to the best of our ability. It's a very Puritan concept, and that's why the School of Geneva blew up and was huge. And actually, our founding father, who is a deist, Thomas Jefferson, wanted to buy the School of Geneva because he saw the value of it, and he wanted to move it to the United States. And there is something to that about even whether it's the institution that we're in or the institution that we go to start, if we're following biblical principles and we're doing a good job, Lord willing, it should be one of the best institutions.
Is there a risk of, it's not second order pacifism with that, which is, if I do the right things and we're a Christian, if we believe the right things and we do the right things, then we will have the dominant school. Is that?
No, I guess I wouldn't go to that length. The way I said it would be incorrect if that's
okay. Because that a bit of Neoplatonism, but I got you.
Yeah, no, that's absolutely true. Because not what I said. What your criticism is absolutely accurate. Because
okay, so
we've had preachers who.
Go back to what you said and then finish this point if you can for me.
Okay. So I guess I wasn't trying to be so concrete. I'm saying if you have an institution that godly men are enacting biblical principles within, it should be a premier institution, right? Just by the laws of nature. Like if you are working hard and you are honest and you have integrity with your dealings. And like, these are all things, if you read through Proverbs and you follow it all, it's a pretty good business plan. Like these are all things that should lead towards success. Now, obviously God's plan isn't that every Christian institution is successful or every church is successful. You could have a church where the pastor is preaching the gospel faithfully and truthfully, and it might not be God's will for that church to grow. And you might have a different plan. So it's definitely not as concrete as I stated it the first time, if that was.
No, I that helps. That helps because there's a couple of kind of concepts that are not concepts. There's some commonalities that might that can be brought up. Like one of them is, if persecution comes to the United States, are the faithful Christians to blame for not being more faithful? And then the other one would be something like Saint Cyprian and the Lapsed, right? So there was persecution of the early church during the Roman era. Are the faithful Christians responsible for that persecution? Or are they responsible for not building up the faith of those who are not faithful? I'm not saying this is a very complicated issue. I think that it's one of those things that like gets foregone all the time. You see it, but you see it repeated in multiple places. Like the whole, why do we hate like self-isolating, bunker building, bean stocking preppers? Because they're selfish assholes. That's why. They're really frustrating people because it's all about them and it's clearly all about their ego, because if it really was about whatever their survival is, they wouldn't be telling you about it.
Right.
But it's more about, I need to like feel a sense of importance. Right.
Yeah. And so it's incredibly short-sighted.
It's just selfish. That's all it is. It's selfish. It's the kind of selfishness that the Native Americans built the Wendigo concept off of. And a Wendigo was not, or Wendigo an antlered beast walking in the woods. It was a man who was selfish and hoarded during a time of difficulty, and his heart was turned to ice. And so, and he became
your logo makes way more sense then.
It's written, it's made, this one's drawn by Gypsy. And so this was for like season one, cool. Operation two. We did this a year ago now. Gypsy Walters, you know, shout out to a great and amazing artist. If you're ever looking for you know, graphic design for your business, really go check him out. He's done a fantastic work for a long time. But
yeah, your stuff is sweet.
His stuff is great. And then I am just a pale comparison. I'm more of the mind in the words.
I meant yours inclusively.
Oh, thank you. But oh, dude. Totally. Well, if he's listening, so thank you very much. So, but my point on that one is like this, I want to pull away from, I'm using the prepper as an example of like, it's the I got mine guy, right? So, and I keep doing this, I keep saying, right, it's the I got mine guy. If you've been in a military institution that requires a sort of pseudo rite of passage, like Ranger School or RIP or RASP or whatever, the I got mine guy is the guy who doesn't value the tab for what the tab is. He's trying to protect his sense of self-importance by isolating others from having access to the tab. And it's not in an earnest way where he only wants those who are worthy to pursue it. It's sort of like, if no one is worthy, then I am the best. This is a very disingenuous, dishonest way of approaching it. Within the prepper world, the isolationist, I got mine beans and biscuits and whatever, it's not that the issue with those people is never that they're not prepared. Their preparation is fantastic. It's that they, and it's not that they're obligated in a moral sense to look out after everybody else. It's very clear that they are selfish people who are too cowardly to live out their own activities now and are trying to justify the potentiality of future violence by whatever circumstances may play out. Why would you tell me about your 50 cal machine gun that you're going to use to gun down the hordes of people who are stealing your food? Like, it's not just bad tactics, it's immorally annoying. And it's not the prepping part that's immoral. It's that you're saying, well, if it comes down to, you know, a hard time, I'm willing to do the great evil just to survive. You're not that guy, man. You're not Jesus Christ. You're not that cool. And so, and then in Christianity, especially in our faith, I've seen this before where it's if the nation needs to turn to Christ or it's going to fall apart, where are you to play in that part? Are you responsible if it falls apart? Are you responsible? Not the guy you're speaking to, not your church or the nation or the president. Where is your responsibility? Do you deserve the persecution that you receive?
Interesting. Because I understand that philosophically, but then we would also have to address the promises that we do find biblically for nations and societies whose God is the Lord, right? So we do engage in some of that behavior based on the confidence in those promises that if we do X, usually Y happens. And I know biblical promises aren't always that simple, but that's just my first knee-jerk reaction to that. I don't know if it's one or the other. Because I definitely before would have maybe sounded a little bit more like what you just said, but now I definitely tend more towards the our hope is in Christ and not much else. And I don't necessarily mean that we need to have a Christian government that everybody submits to, but that we would have a converted Christian populace that then raises up a government based on Christian principles. And I know there's probably a lot of people in gun culture who are not going to appreciate this mentality, but that's I have limited conversations with the anarchists and such.
Anarchy is its own problem. Anarchy is its own problem. There's a growing, not growing, but the representation of this issue oftentimes comes out in sort of a, we have to have a common set of beliefs. And because we don't have a common set of beliefs, we're falling apart. What is the common set of beliefs that you're proposing? And if you don't have one, then why are you talking? It's not. Okay. That's a bit sharper than it needs to be.
No, I think I understand what you're saying. Then it's like when you have people with a surface ideology or a surface belief system that say everybody needs to believe in my belief system that I really only believe at a surface level. Otherwise, it's all going downhill. But if you poked them or asked them really any questions deeper than that surface level, they wouldn't even know what to tell you anyways. So like you're saying, well, what principles are you actually talking about? What values would you actually have people share? And unfortunately, a lot of the American Christian church today would not be able to answer you very well.
I'm also thinking of like casual Nietzsche enjoyers where you're like, oh, Nietzsche was talking about how, you know, we didn't have collected belief systems anymore. Like Nietzsche lost the battle against nihilism. That's what killed him. Nietzsche fought against nihilism and lost.
Yeah.
I don't know. I'm not going to go so far down the rabbit hole to build that out, but fine. So, well, let's dial it back a little bit then. Let's kind of pull back a layer and go back to that part on if there's this Old Testament pattern that the people of Israel and then later the people of Israel and Judah follow through, which is they follow God and they find success, and then they stop following God and they worship Baal, or they leave, they stop obeying the principles and they stop obeying the commandments. And so then they endure suffering and oftentimes even enslavement or war. Not just war, but like negative losing war. They lose battles. Their kings are killed almost miraculously oftentimes. And then they repent and they become faithful. The next generation or whatever, even in that generation, returns to being faithful to the commandments and to God. And they experience success. And then they collapse again. And you have this kind of secular experience that goes on for, if I'm not mistaken, the time from Judges to the end of the Kings was 600 years. I think that was a 600. It might have been an 800-year period, which is when we're looking at BC time, we're kind of going, oh, this is a big window. But I want to say it was something like 600 years between the end of the conquest of Canaan and the beginning of, or the end of the conquest of Canaan and the end of this cycle between faithfulness. Almost like it's almost like that book that everyone likes to quote, the following God creates, you know, like following God creates good times, not following God creates bad times. Bad times cause people to turn back to God and repent. Good times cause people to leave God and into sin. It's like this double-layered four-square thing.
Yeah. Which, if the church is just modern-day Israel, then I guess there could be a discussion there as to if we're going to follow those same cycles. Although the one thing that I would be interested in comparing between the two is that today we have the Holy Spirit. So we have God among us, right?
Remind me why you brought up that you said the church is modern day Israel or America is modern day Israel?
The church. Yeah.
Okay. Yeah. Thank you.
Yeah. So if I said America, that was not my intention at all. I don't think.
No, I didn't think you did. That was something else. You said the church is modern day Israel. Okay.
Yep. So that's the difference between your dispensationalist view and your covenantal view. The covenantal view would be that these covenants have fulfilled each other and that they are progressive from beginning to end, whereas dispensationalism kind of believes that there's the covenant of Israel or the dispensation of Israel and the promises to them, which kind of go on this separate path, and then modern day church kind of goes a separate path, somewhat parallel, and that's something I've separated from.
Have you encountered many people who are hardcore dispensationalists?
Most people who are dispensationalists don't know what it means.
It's a fair enough point. Most people who are egalitarians don't know what it means either.
Yeah, and it's interesting because you do have a lot of, at least in my circles, we have a lot of people who are very, very pro modern day Israel because of a dispensationalist view. But I don't think they understand the finer points of the theology or why they even have that position. It's more of a, I was raised this way. This is the way the theology was brought up. They are taught some of the promises that were given to Israel through scripture. So they're very convicted about scripture and they want to be true to God's word. So they believe that these promises carry through. But I don't think most of them have even ever been offered or considered covenant theology. So, I know that when I went to Bible college, most people in those classrooms had no idea about the differences between the two. And a lot of these are lifelong Christians.
I was in college for a degree in theology, and we had a course on dispensationalism versus covenant theology. And I don't think it's not a criticism to the professor who taught it. It's that it seemed like both of them, the texts that we read on both of them, were so directed towards sort of an ulterior motive, even if that ulterior motive isn't necessarily malicious. It's more like, well, dispensationalism allows us to argue for almost like a two-state theology, whereas covenant theology was a little bit softer on the borderlines, but then also suffered on softness on what was really the hardcore statement. And so I know that's a bit broadly painting these two different worldviews. And I'm sure to people who are well versed in both covenant and dispensational theology, they would probably find this a little irritating. And
yeah, my brother's probably tearing his hair out if he's listening to this.
Oh, good for him. Yeah, good for him.
He's like, you should be explaining this better.
Well, it is a thing that requires some work, and it's not work in the sense of weeding the garden or fixing the lawnmower, but it is work in the sense that you got to read a little bit, and you're going to make it just fine. So,
yeah,
let's do a pretty hard pivot then. And what is the do you have like phases or like, you know, young adulthood and where you're at now or being married or whatever that had to do with how you approached gun culture like that? Can you elaborate on that a little bit?
So I grew up very conservative country type scenario, a lot more of like your typical conservatism, kind of like what gun culture would refer to as like kind of FUDs. And then at the same time, I had two brothers who went off to fight in the GWAT right around its peak and got some pretty wild experiences through that. So they came home and gave me some kind of like, I don't know, based views, if you would. As a high schooler, I'm absorbing these different views and opinions, and some of them from guys who were pretty dark and jaded at the time as well. And then I kind of got involved in guns a little bit just through that. Like, I want to do what my brothers are doing, so we're shoot some guns here and there. But it actually came more into my wheelhouse as to what I was actually practicing with hunting. Towards the end of high school and into college, I met my now wife, and her family's really big into hunting. So I got into hunting, had to have the right tools for that. And then I always knew how I felt about like the AR-15. Like, I knew the logic behind the gun control arguments and stuff, and like, okay, like, it's the weapons of war and just like all the silliness that went along with that. So I could defend the AR-15 rationally day in and day out, but I didn't own one. I wasn't in the circles of people that owned one. I don't know if I knew more than a handful of people that did. And then around 2020, there was a pretty significant push. I don't remember if it was federally or in New York State, but it was looking like we weren't going to be able to get them anymore if the law, whatever law was proposed, went through. And I was like, oh, I should probably get one of these before it is completely off the table. So I got an AR-15. Then I had like four or five friends who wanted them, so I helped with purchases and builds and stuff. You're helping them decide on what to purchase and whatnot. And then through that, just kind of, I'm kind of like autistic, if you will, when it comes to like hyperfixation on things. So now I'm like into this topic and I'm like, I need to know how to build this thing. I need to know how to work this thing. I need to know all the different options and attachments and like everybody does when they first get into gun culture, right?
Yeah, you're drinking out of a fire hydrant without a full evaluation of like what it is, without a full method of evaluation of all the things that you're looking at.
Right. But luckily, I had a pretty good foundation as far as like I had the guys with combat experience in my life who were like, that's snake oil, that's stupid, don't buy that. Like, maybe even to a little bit of like the only way is the old school way kind of mentality. But even so, it was a lot more focused on training. Like these guys were like, you got to know how to use the thing before you worry about slapping all this stuff on it. So from there, I got pretty serious just about, I guess I should rewind a little bit. 2, 3, maybe even 4 years before I got my first AR-15, I got my first handgun. And it was a FN Herstal FNS9. So I bought a full-sized handgun for my concealed carry gun because I was going to be working armed security at the time. So I wanted to have something that could do both. And I was serious about dry fire at the time. Like I said, I had been following Lucas and Josh Lowry and James Yeager. And at the time, John Lovell were just starting to get big on the scene. So I was like, I knew dry fire was something I had to do and was pretty serious about it. And then roll into all the AR-15 stuff. And then right before or just during when I got my first rifle, semi-automatic rifle, the AR, was about the time that I started coming out of that rut. Like that I was like, okay, I have to do something. And maybe it helped with like these other people who wanted to be involved or wanted to learn these skills. So that was when I started getting more involved in gun culture, meeting people in the industry, in the community, making a social media account more dedicated towards that angle. And it's really kind of just been learning from there.
I think there's it's just, I think. You said you're in a rut, and then around the same time that you're getting out of this rut, and let's say that the rut was very much so worldview, pessimism, end of high school, growth, development, young adulthood life. A little bit, you had to go through a little bit of that cynical phase. So yep. Nihilism gives way to cynicism. Nihilism meets the world, encounters where it's wrong, and it creates a void, and that void is filled by cynicism. Cynicism takes that, and eventually cynicism has to die. It has to kill itself in order to make room for nihilism, or not nihilism. It has to let itself die and put it away, and sort of like fear, observe it, contain it, put it away, and then you can move on to the next phase. This, at the same time that that's happening in your adult life, you're also becoming interested in learning how to do this stuff and learning how to do it more than just a concealed carry capacity. What do you think? Which one? This goes back to the question we had earlier. Which one do you think informed the other?
Well, I think I always knew, rolling right into it, that I wanted to have more of like the modern Minuteman mentality. There was some big, I thought they were big. I mean, they're big to me, influential to me, pages at the time who were really pushing the modern Minuteman. And they kind of set up a structure for that I liked, just as far as like ideology and purpose and intent and whatnot. And I was like, okay, so this is cool. Like, this is, you have a goal, you have something to aim for, you have somewhat of like a rough outline of like steps, like, okay, you should understand how to do X, Y, Z, and then you should attain this gear. And at the same time, I don't think getting too far into that where I was like neglecting the reality of like, it's concealed carry is really the focus. Like, that's what you're far more likely to ever need to utilize. So I don't think that the AR-15 side of things really informed the other. It was more of like, I have these responsibilities and these concerns, and in order of priority, I want to make sure that I'm equipped to handle whatever might come. And I think that was then started developing in more of my biblical understanding of like the call to fulfill these roles and responsibilities.
Well, no, that's wonderful to hear. It's not my theory, but you saying that encourages me in the sense that I really don't believe people are motivated to remain or participate in gun culture simply out of a sense of fear over what could happen. Like, I have to have a gun because something bad could happen, the sort of reactionary, or that it's just a power fantasy. I think both of those are projections. Mostly projections, yeah.
The people who jumped on board solely out of fear initially, I mean, got their rifles, got some gear, whatever, are completely out of the picture now. Like, those people haven't trained, as far as I know. They haven't taken it seriously as far as taking other preps or whatever. It was really just like, this is the world falling apart right now, and do I need to have a way to defend my family? And they took that first fear initiated step, and then we're kind of content with that. So I think you're right in saying that the people who stay in gun culture aren't the people who are just perpetually afraid, or the people who really have a perpetual power trip. Although it might tend more towards that direction than the other, but
I guess what about this then, is that while it may be either the power fantasy of a video game or a situational onset of fear, like 2020, living in Minneapolis in 2020, those things might get people in the door, but they're not what sustain people.
Right.
You see this, you think about this in like food and nutrition. Like, sugar will wake you up in the morning, but you will have a crash. Whereas if you eat something and you eat something with some substance, it's not going to give you this this punch of energy or even pseudo energy right away, but it will sustain you longer into the day.
It'll carry you through.
Yeah. Or another one is like, I might wake up in the morning and brew a cup of coffee, but if I just drink coffee, I will have a crash. The coffee is that sense of fear or a little bit of that power fantasy. But those two things, if you take the power fantasy route, you realize that none of us are really into that anymore or at all. And if you take the fear route, it's just a bad motivator. And I'm not talking about Machiavellian fear. I'm really not talking about government Machiavellian fear. I'm talking about like panic buying. But then there's something underneath it that maybe the coffee gets you to wake up and make the eggs and the protein in the morning, but it's the protein that sustains you through the day, not the coffee and the sugar. So
yeah, it's really, I mean, that's why I try to push so heavily the convictions behind these practices and values and whatnot, because even in person at our range days, it's very, very common. I think probably most of the guys who have attended could tell you that exact phrase, that, you know, I'm concerned about equipping men to fulfill the roles and responsibilities that we find in scripture.
And our range days?
I just talk as a group, like my community.
Yeah. I'm not putting the communist logo up. I'm saying our range days. Tell me more.
Oh yeah. So, after this all kind of developed and I got into just training more often, I built a community, built a circle of people who have the same convictions and want to be men of God who embrace those responsibilities of protecting and defending the weak and the defenseless, and being, like we said, modern day Minutemen, so to speak, that these this value that has been lost in our society, that the early Americans had to be either like colonists or frontiersmen. And then either way, depending on where you were at, you kind of had to be involved in this resistance. And even though we don't have anything physically right now to resist, we have lost the skill set and the mentality of being capable of being those men. And
you've mentioned Minuteman twice now, and both times you referenced them in a context that wasn't a contrast to an existing threat, but rather their primary identified attachment was to their community. The Minuteman, in both examples that you've given right now, was not somebody who was responding to a threat, but somebody who was responsible to a community.
Yes.
Can you expand? Yeah, can you expand on that at all?
That's the way I look at it, because I'm not even really seeing a realistic future where we might have to don our kit in under a minute and respond to a scenario. I hope that never happens. If it does, though, I want to know that there's been a culture built up around my community of men that are capable of doing that. And I think that the reason I look at it this way, that it's built around values and community, is because those disciplines, like martial arts, which I have a history in, so it has some parallels, those disciplines build other values, right? So being capable with a firearm and having the gear and having the discipline and the training isn't just valuable for those reasons. It's also valuable because you learn other disciplines and core values from those practices. And this is where we kind of see a little bit of a contradiction. Actually, Derek from Bull Creek Strategic brought this up in the comment section of one of my posts recently. And you mentioned it before the recording here started, that gun culture isn't really ever satisfied because it's gun culture. It's an item, right? This is equipment oriented. It's a culture around the equipment. Whereas Derek's really serious about pushing the idea that it's a warrior culture. And in my verbiage from before, modern Minutemen, that it's a culture of capability and capacity. Insert iconic Jordan Peterson quote here. And that's where the value comes from.
That the distinction that you made there. It's not really about gun culture. How have you seen that you've described almost like a series of values? How have you seen that in your community? Like, in your local community, or in the way that, and where have you seen places where you missed the mark, or maybe is, if that's even appropriate? Yeah, that, I think that's what I was going to ask. I think that's where I want to go with that one, is the community aspect. Like, there's a lot of this, and I struggle with this, or I even fall into this myself. There's enough talk about community building. And while there are examples, right, there's examples of people or things, like we're putting on, or by the time this is aired, we've put on another range cleanup event, which is our public land cleanup. It's a thing. You've got other people doing it. You got Marcus Singletary over at Cloaked and Tricot, who's hosting community days. You've got Brent up in Washington, who's got his kind of range days. And you've got, and these are just people that I know that I've talked to. I know of other ones that are not as public of individuals who are doing similar things, and they're all focused on kind of being around like-minded people and doing similar things. And the fear, it's not the fear. The community aspect of it is even somehow secondary to believing something to be right and true and good and pursuing it as part of your public participation. I'm struggling with this one. I'm struggling with this one because I'm not the best at it. But please help me out here.
I don't know, you know, if right? I would say that the values are necessarily just based on my relationship with the public, like my public responsibilities. No. I would say it's even private, which is kind of tends into like the martial arts mentality, or the martial way, or the way of the warrior, whatever you want to call it, that these disciplines are healthy for a man. They are good because it's good to be capable. And that evolves into, when you take it to the community level, kind of a systematized hierarchy of values as far as how this works as a group, or with a value like preparedness, right? Is you kind of have to, you're not just wasting your own time at that point. Like, you're wasting other people's time if you're messing it up. So I have to make sure that what I'm focused on spreading is valuable for people, in an order of priority. So I don't know if that's where you were headed with it, but that's kind of,
I'm wrestling with something, which is the, I'll just kind of pull back a little bit. I'm looking for the barrier that seems to stand between the desire or even sense of urgency for people to have community and what it is that causes them to set down the urgency and pick up the community. And I'm looking for that in myself as well as in gun culture as a whole, almost like a very, not cynical, but detached anthropologist, in the sense of, what is it that happens in people where they go from, I need community and a sense of urgency with that too, or I need and or want to be in a sense of community with my people or people similar, like-minded people too. It's not so much that I've achieved it or that it's been achieved, but to no longer, to have that like sense of urgency assuaged or healed or right. Like it's not, I think it comes and goes in waves, but it's just like, what's the answer to the community question, right?
I was going to say, is it just that the fact that the people who have started their community have something to work with? Whereas like, actually you mentioned Marcus, your last podcast with him was awesome. And he talked a lot about buy-in, which was a way that I hadn't thought about it before, but that when you have a community now that you can buy into, you kind of assuage those feelings of, urgency for building that community.
I think what I've witnessed in some of the writing around motorcycle gangs is the same thing, as well as like church communities, as well as sort of neo-tribalism that whole framework, that whole like, I need a sense of belonging and I find sense of belonging by picking a specific group, being a part of Ranger Battalion or 19th Group or Special Forces or a SWAT team or a police officer.
So for me, it wasn't necessarily the need for community, because I've been thinking about this a lot lately. I already have community. in the church. That is my number one community. And the guys that I train with are well aware of this, that like, they are my priority. That is my family. Even more so than some of my blood relatives, that, those are the people that I do life with. I see them multiple times a week. I'm messaging them regularly. Many of them are really my friends in real life, you know, not just once a week visit and say hi and do niceties. We wrestle through life events together. We have traumas together. We have victories together. And that's my community. So my training group is basically just that. It's a training group. And it's mostly comprised of that community, but expanded. So it's mostly people that fall into that same category. And it's not necessarily intentional. It's just that that's how it's worked out. And it's that those are where I found the people that I find to have the genuine convictions that you're talking about, that we want them to actually have a conviction about the reason for being prepared, the reason for being capable. I don't want to just take any random person off the street necessarily and encourage them to be capable of violence, you know, if I don't know anything about them. That might be their moral right to be capable, but that doesn't mean I need to be involved in it. And for the people that I'm involved with, I want to make sure that I'm on the same page as them. And that's why the community thing for me, I didn't build my training group because I needed community. Although it does have an aspect of that. Like, those are in my order, my hierarchy of values, if you will. Those are my next level outside of the church.
So your sense of community does not come from gun culture.
No, not necessarily. I would say it's been nice. It's been encouraging, especially with the direction that gun culture has been taking recently. It's kind of an expanded community, but even then, like, I don't know if I said it already on this or if I said it before, but that, when I scroll my Instagram, it's a bunch of guys being like, Christ is King, you know, Soli Deo Gloria, like, and sharing wholesome, good content. And in a way, that's just the church community on a broader scale. So those people are my brothers in Christ. And some of them, many of them. And it's kind of not as intimate of a community, not as real of an in-person community, obviously. But no, I didn't go looking for my valuable heartfelt community in like the local gun club or shooting ranges or anything like that. Which I actually commented on. I don't know if it was one of Marcus's posts, or maybe I made it as a status or a story or whatever. But I said the community that everybody's looking for already exists. Like, everybody talks about gun culture, gun community, like, oh, you got to build your community, you got to build your tribe. Like, guess what? It's already there. They just need to be trained and capable.
It reminds me of like, it reminds me of the veteran who misses being a part of the boys. And the issue is that being a person serving in the military can only happen for so long.
Right.
Like that and it's like what it ends up. The community is a layered reflection of your values. So your or even what you value, and your values are a reflection of what you place your identity in. And so layers, if your sense of community, I wonder if this is this sorry, this just draws such a a good, I'm not trying to expand on your argument. I think you've done a good job with this one. It's actually pretty clean when you realize that that sense of belonging that the military gave you was only a cheap copy of something that will last until you're dead. And that is, you do not place your community in your job. Yeah.
Yeah, and I mean, another big part of that is that, because there's going to be a lot of people who will comment and say, well, I've gone to a church and I've never felt that level of community. And I would say, what level of responsibility have you taken on? Because you're not going to feel connected to a community that you have no responsibility within, which is why in the military, that community bond is so strong, because not only are you there to reap the benefits of the relationship and of the community, but you have a job and people rely on you to do that job and to do it well. And that's not something that you find to the same level, really, at least in the physical sense, in the civilian world. If you go to church and you don't contribute and you don't embrace any responsibility, then yeah, you're not really going to experience the level of community that I'm talking about.
That's an excellent challenge. That's an excellent challenge. No, I think it's very valuable. I admittedly feel the sting of conviction in it as well. I think it's a valuable piece to say.
Oh, this is new for me, and it's I'm speaking from experience here. So,
yeah, no, if you so in summary, I'm gonna try to summarize what you're saying is that you will not be able to have a sense of community if you're not willingly contributing, and particularly in the church, which can last from death or from birth to death, instead of a chapter of your life, that if you're not, I know there's going to be exceptions and there's going to be challenges and there's going to be issues, like,
of course,
you know, the church that I go in, I don't find any other men that I get along with, and I know that the church or you know, my church is run by women, like the pastor's a woman, like, you're not going to a church, dude.
Go to a different church.
Go to a different church. And I see this out of even out of confession too. Not in the Catholic sense, but in the Reformed sense, that, like, you know what? Sometimes you complain about the problem. Going even back to Stoicism with Marcus Aurelius, in the sense of, like, the thing that is getting in your way is the thing that you need to challenge. I am taking on personal sense of conviction from this.
Yeah. Yeah. Well, I would say, yeah, that's a good way to summarize it.
Wonderful. Wonderful. I have much to think about. So moving on.
Well, it's only fair because I'm constantly listening to these podcasts and you're constantly hurting my brain. So hopefully this can be a little bit of a...
We must dialogue respectfully, if not at all, to know. Something poetic and long and kind of old English sounding. There you go. I made a beautiful quote. It's not as Charles Bukowski as you could be. Well, that's encouraging. I was reading, who is it? Bonhoeffer's book. Oof. On Christian community. And while there are entire sections of it that just sound sort of not like exposition, but just, okay, next, like, okay, like what some people would describe as Christianese, is just get to the point. Mm-hmm. He makes a statement that's early on, which is probably the most quoted section from the book, and for good reason. Like, there's a series of lines from not mere Christianity, but the abolition of man that get quoted many times, best lines. But he's like, there is no community that is not built on the church. It is all just a facade. And of course, this is the German into the English translation. And I wonder how oftentimes we say that but don't believe it.
Yeah. Yeah, it's, I think that's a notion that people haven't really embraced for a long time. I think the church has kind of been cheapened and has been undervalued. And because of that, people kind of, church is just something that they add on to their checklist for the week for a lot of Christians. And I think,
I don't agree with you. I think that may have been the boomer generation, but not ours.
I don't think that's our generation, because our generation just won't go to church if they don't feel the call. You know, boomer generation would go out of tradition or obligation or whatever. But
I think our generation, and this is projection, so if you're going to say it's not the iron law of woke projection, but it is projection. I think our generation is too comfortable in their cynicism to give it a shot.
To give it a shot. You mean you don't think they're coming to church?
I think many of us are in pursuit of the faith. I don't think that it's some sort of rational skepticism that's in the way. I don't think it's some sort of like, what's the word? Who was the guy? Not Dawkins, but Sam Harris sort of rational skepticism that stands in the way of this kind of participation. I think it's something like I think it's mostly a combination of cynicism. Like, I'm excluding all the people who are that they hate the good because it is good. And we're talking about, like, there are very clear examples of characters in this world where, whether it's a season in their life or it is their identity that they've invested in or that they've made manifest as their sole purpose or their sole point of reality, atheist bros and stuff like that, is that outside of like these kind of exceptions, there's a bit of cynicism, and I'm saying this even from my own sense. I don't mean it. I mean it as a form of like I know this because I've been this person. So
I don't know if it's the same vein as what you're talking about, but there was definitely a time in my life where I strayed away from going to church, and I had really probably good excuses for not going, but that's all they were excuses. So it would sound right to the people around me. But I felt cynical about most of the churches that I visited. Thankfully, actually, the church I'm part of now was kind of a reboot or a startup. So I got to see a lot of it from the ground level up, and it's fairly unique in our community. But even so, there was a lot of learning that I had to do in order to just even realize what I wanted from a church. And then basically what I knew was what I didn't want in a church, but I didn't really know what I wanted in one or how to facilitate that. So I think I'm resonating with what you're saying, and that like there is a cynicism about going to church.
It's a bit of it's wanton projection, but yeah, wanton projection. But I think, yeah, we're approaching it as a society where the secular age being coming to a close, which sounds like a nice way of describing something. But the secular age, I believe the secular age is coming to a close, and the secular age was defined by. Yeah, and the secular age that was defined not so much by like the Sam Harris, Richard Dawkins, Daniel Dennett type of atheism, but it was defined by the trivialization of beliefs into a mere set of fashion statements.
Yeah.
And it is best described, it is best manifested in our current contemporary political environment with Joe Biden or the White House talking about the transgender day of visibility over Easter weekend. Because in that sense, those two things, Easter and transgenderism, can't be in contradiction, because one's a fashion statement and one's a religion. And Christians will be fools to think that Christianity in that description is a religion. The people who are talking, that the argument that you can celebrate the trans day of visibility and Easter is the argument that transgenderism is a religion and Easter is fashion. You're just wearing the smock for fun.
Right.
Mm-hmm. It's what you, how you're, it's a form of self-expression. Religion is not a form of self-expression.
I agree with that, yeah. Even though all too often we use it as one.
Naturally, it's what informs our values.
Yeah, that's kind of what I would go back to, is conversation that's been happening a lot in the DMs, and I mentioned it a bit earlier, was just if we're talking about a human-centric Christianity where I'm really just doing this Christianity thing because it makes me feel good to know that I've been saved, or to know that I'm, you know, accepted by God, or to know, like, it's all really about me. Like, I just want to feel good. I want to feel better. I don't want to be angry or sad or in despair. So I pursue this religion, and Christianity sounds pretty good, so I'll do that. And we've mentioned how it's surface level so far. We've mentioned how it's human centric, and that's just a false Christianity. And we see that a lot embraced in like the prosperity gospel centers, is where people really focus on it. But I think it's pervasive in every aspect of Christianity, where people really don't understand until they come to the point where they have a God-centric understanding of reality, and realizing that, like, I'm not the main character in this story. I'm not even in the driver's seat. Like, it's all him, and I comply, is basically how it works.
Very good. Very good. All right. Let's start tying it down then. I think this has been a really good... there's one thing, this is going to be a side note, there's one thing about Joe Rogan podcasts that I just really dislike, is that they just suddenly end. You're like, there's a multiple times where he's had guests on where, like, I'm listening to it and I'm doing what I'm doing, or maybe I'm just listening to it, and then he's like, all right, cool, we're done, bye. And I it just, every time I'm like, that's not a cliffhanger. Right. That's a lack of conclusion.
He probably does it with the intent to avoid what tends to happen sometimes, where people are like, all right, we're leaving now. And then they talk for 10, 15 more minutes. And okay,
we're leaving now. From Minnesota. It's called a Minnesota goodbye. You don't get away from this. All right. You do not get out of this one. There is no escape. I need to get Charlie Burns on the show to talk about that, though. The Midwest goodbye, where you're like, okay, well, you know, one decade later. Right. But well, we're going to let that one pass. Do they have those? Do they have those in your neck of the woods?
So. I see a lot of the Midwest stuff resonate with where I'm at, but I also see a lot of just like the typical rude New Yorker mentality where people are just like, all right, peace out. See ya. So depends on who you get.
Uncivilized, you uncouth. Uncouth Eastern East Coasters. Huh. Well, then let's go with this one. What is something that you've been reading lately? What is something that you've been training lately? And what is something that you have learned, or that you would... what is something that you've been reading lately first? And then I'll get the third question out. It'll be a surprise.
Oh, man. I'm going to forget the name of the book.
Is it in English?
Yes, it is in English. It's something about being in Christ. I think I made a... Oh, actually, here, I'll have a picture of it. It talks about a lot of the Pauline epistles and how he loves this phrase, in Christ. He talks about the church in Christ, about believers in Christ. It talks about all the different dynamics and aspects of that. The name of the book is Union with Christ by Lewis B. Smeeds. And I think it's actually a condensed version of one of his earlier books. It's my first time ever interacting with him, so don't take it as a recommendation necessarily, but I've enjoyed it so far because he actually does a lot of comparing different views, and it's been a lot deeper than I expected it to be. It's a meaningful book to me for a variety of other circumstantial reasons, but that's a book I'm working on right now. Something I'm training... We've been focusing a lot on comms, trying to understand the value for different applications, and just trying to, again, we're not super wealthy, you know, can just afford to do everything type people around here. So we're trying to really figure out where the best bang for buck is in regards to the whole comms discussion, and then trying to make sure that we can be effective with what we have. And then what was the third thing?
I didn't give you the third thing.
Oh, okay.
I didn't at all. I left it. I kind of left it as an open air, and I'm realizing that. So we did a book, something that you're training. And then the third question would be, if the summer of 2024 went the way, what is the best outcome for the summer of 2024? This is before the election, but now, like the next 3 to 6 months of your life, what would you see as a good thing?
My tomato plant's not all dying of blight this year would be awesome.
Oh.
Yeah, that would be fantastic, because last year our garden probably had half its yield that it should have. We still ended up canning 200 to 300, maybe 275 cans of food. So that was good. But yeah, our garden did not respond well last season. You so can- this summer would be awesome. Food-
You gun-owning, food-canning Christian nationalist, you.
Oh, my goodness. We didn't even get into the homesteading side of things yet. Like,
We did not even get into the homesteading side. And it's a topic that I've been not necessarily treating with kid gloves, but it's also it is what it is. The homesteading thing is, I asked a question earlier, is homesteading just Christian Amish?
I don't know. I've been called Amish a lot growing up. So there's, I guess, potential there, but, I'm actually probably a really bad person to ask that to, because we got rid of our TV when we moved into our house, and, our living room is an actual social area now. So, I will use that.
Oh, we did the same thing. Our living room is a social area. We don't. Yeah. We have a television in the home, but it's not the center point. You have to go you have to go into the TV room to watch the TV.
Yeah, it's like the quote from Friends where Joey's like, "You don't have a TV. What's all your furniture point at?" And like, it's kind of sad that that's where we're at as a society, but it is. But for me,
I'm gonna out homestead you. I haven't seen that episode of Friends.
Oh, man. I wouldn't have, but my wife was obsessed with it when we first got together. So I've seen every episode a handful of times. So I will say that's one of the things that got me out of my rut was I decided that I wasn't going to do things that only checked one box. And for me, video games and Netflix only checked one box, entertainment. And I decided if I can be entertained by raising chickens or by doing a garden or by whatever other myriad of things, then I'm going to spend my time doing things that check multiple boxes, because time is limited and we have many responsibilities. So I want to be responsible with my time. So yeah, maybe a little bit of Christian Amish going on there, because I don't know, connection to the land and stuff. It's good.
Connection to the land is not bad. I've laughed at it a little bit. And I think my reference in Christian Amish is it just choosing simple because simple is easy, or is it doing something that you think is right because it is right? And we'll have to answer that question on another time. So we're going to get you back on, all right?
Yeah, you're making me think.
I know. No, Caleb, we'll definitely have you on again. I enjoy our conversations. The next time, let's just do like homesteading, not just 101, but... Oof. It's not just 101, because it doesn't matter. Like, some of us live in cities, some of us live in the countryside. It certainly is a rural lifestyle. We're not the first people to do homesteading, right? Even that sense, like my parents, my father, or my in-laws, like my grandfather didn't, but there was this sort of ebb and flow of urbanization to rural. Yeah. And, but I think sometimes I wonder if homesteading is something that people place on the pedestal of the ideal, like Jeffersonian, what do you call it? Jeffersonian
agrarianism,
landed gentry, agrarianism, which is, I don't know if that's achievable with when you have like 10 million people who live in Minneapolis. 4 right. million of them who can read. And then, wrapping that up, this was kind of the, I want to hear more about your homesteading, not just journey, but things that are less than, less like trendy. Like I can hear Tim Pool talk about chickens. I can hear.
Right. Well, we started in an apartment with no yard. So.
Well, there you go.
You can do it anywhere. And it's not, I don't like the term homesteading because like you said, it means too much. And at the same time, means nothing because it's been so overused. But at the same time, like gun culture, what else do I call it? It's
I don't mind the term. I don't mind terms that are a little bit broad and a little bit vague. That's not the issue. The issue is if you're going to criticize its brevity or its vagueness, then find a solution to it. And okay, well, gun culture is too broad. Fine, my milieu. The people in my cell phone.
Mm-hmm.
Do I have your writing address? You know. Okay, fine.
Yeah.
But all right. Well, hey, where do people find you? And if they want to follow you, where do they find some homesteading tips?
Well, the homesteading tips are definitely more of my wife's gig. She has a social media account that
gotcha.
Is 1 Acre Homemaking, and she is the one you want to follow for all that. At the same time, if you want to follow more of the gun culture-y side of things, the Founding Fathers.
You've got this you've got this series on the Founding Fathers. I think it's a great value. Go ahead.
Yeah. That is on my page, Caleb Prevail Armament. And I could list everything off, but I've got a website and a bunch of different socials. So if you go to my Instagram, there's a link where you can see everything listed out. So that's the easiest way.
We'll put a link in the description below. Sounds that.
That too. That works.
All right, cool. All right, well then this has been the Redacted Culture Cast. This episode was brought to you by Obsidian Arms. They are a OEM shop and tool maker out of Minnesota. They have supported the show and they are the place to go if you're looking for armors or gunsmith tools. And for one reason specifically, their tools come with a lifetime warranty, not to mention that they are made with precision. So go and give them a shot. And if you want to support our channel, you can head over to redactedllc.com or you can go to redactedculture.locals.com and jump in the conversation. With that being said, we've had Caleb of Prevail Armament on tonight, and we will talk to you soon. Go forth and conquer.